Thank you. Thanks, Asaf, and thanks, Alex. It's great to be here. It's great to digitally see you. I hope to see you in person very, very soon. It's been too long. So I really appreciate the invitation, and it seems to me that the question of China in the Middle East is one of the lesser known but most consequential stories that's coming out of the region, and it's going to be a real shaping force in the years ahead. So I really appreciate the opportunity to sort of try to explain and demystify it a little bit. So I think the proper place to start here is to understand that Chinese policy towards the Middle East now is very, very different from what it historically has been. Historically, certainly since the end of the Cold War, China has only been interested in the Middle East for effectively two things. The first is as a source of energy, because China, as its economy has grown, the last couple of years, particularly because of COVID, are not dispositive of this trend. But before that, you saw double-digit or high single-digit growth in the Chinese economy for the better part of two decades. And with that growth came an increasingly voracious appetite for energy. China runs a deficit of naturally occurring energy sources. And so what you saw as China grew and strengthened economically was a further and further look afield, if you will, in terms of China seeking energy sources from abroad. And the Middle East, for very good reason, became a very important, very strategic stopping point for them. But that historically has been a bounded relationship. And the second avenue of interest historically for the Chinese in the Middle East has been the sale of arms. China can't hope to compete with the United States and Russia in terms of being a global arms provider, but the Chinese market share in the Middle East was comparatively robust. And it was a place where, particularly if you sort of expand your view of the Middle East to include North Africa, there was a Chinese presence in terms of arms sales and in terms of platforms that Hungary regional states, and sort of all of you know who they are, Hungary regional states really were looking after. So traditionally, that was it, right? That was the alpha and the omega of Chinese policy, energy and arms. But over the last 7-8 years or so, Chinese policy in the Middle East has broadened dramatically. It's now much broader, much more strategic. And it's all tied to one guy. It's all tied to the Chinese president, Xi Jinping, who, since taking power in 2013, has launched a massive foreign policy initiative. It's known by many names, but the name you probably are familiar with is Belt and Road. It's a little bit of a misnomer because it's many belts, many roads. The idea here is China is trying to remake the global order through a whole series of interlocking trade and infrastructure deals. With countries in Southwest Asia, in Central Asia, in Europe, in the Middle East, in Africa, even in Latin America. So it's, I think, a misnomer to call it the Belt and Road. The way I like to explain it is China is trying to erect an empire of dependency. China is trying to expand its economic relations with second world, third world states, and do so in a way that makes them increasingly beholden to Chinese political and economic imperatives and makes them dependent on Chinese largesse. And this was a strategy that was devised by President Xi and has been promoted by him and increasingly by the Communist Party of China as a national construct. But it's been enormously successful. And it's allowed China to enter the regional conversation in the Middle East in a much different way than it has in the past. I would note sort of parenthetically that the extent of Chinese activity in the Middle East is really not well understood, at least not yet. It's underappreciated by Washington. And there are a few scholars who are sort of paying attention to this issue, but in the main, what China is doing has sort of fallen below the policy radar until comparatively recently. But the effects of what China's been doing, the quiet economic ties, quiet political ties, investments, military engagement is all having a real effect. Over the last half decade, China has become the single largest investor in the Middle East. The figure is something upward of $120 billion of Chinese investment in infrastructure projects alone in the Middle East. As of last year, the Chinese government had signed strategic partnerships with a wider range of countries, both in the Middle East and North Africa, everybody from Qatar to Algeria. Sort of the high points here are places like Saudi Arabia, places like the United Arab Emirates, and places like Iran, which we'll talk about in a minute. But the sort of the aggregate effect is that total trade between China and the countries of the Middle East and North Africa is currently estimated at some $290 billion. Which is an exponential growth over the figure that you saw a decade and a half ago. So all of this comes with a cost. I think it's useful to talk about it in this context of sort of expanding Chinese influence and interests in the Middle East to explain what it's doing. And I would point to effectively, there are three trends that are, I think, very worrisome. They're dangerous byproducts of this Chinese entry into the Middle East. The first is that the Chinese have effectively bought Muslim silence. I mean this directly in the context of what is unfolding in the west of China. In the west of China, where I've spent some time, in the autonomous region of Xinjiang, there is a minority called the Uyghurs. They are Chinese Muslims. They're not the only Chinese Muslims. There are, for example, Wei Chinese who are Muslims as well. But all Uyghurs are Muslims. Not all Chinese Muslims are Uyghurs, but all Uyghurs are Muslims. And what the Chinese government has done in tandem with the expansion of the Belt and Road is attempt to in their parlance, to harmonize the region. And this sounds very benign, but it's most definitely not. It has involved this massive clampdown on religious belief, on social mobility. It's resulted in the internment of what the UN estimates as over a million Uyghur Muslims in re-education camps, the creation of forced labor processes, which are now beginning to impact international companies that have traditionally relied on China for manufacturing. You have sort of horrific stories of rape and forced sterilization for Uyghur women, the forceful breakup of Uyghur families, things that cumulatively the Trump administration ended up deciding in sort of in the 11th hour that it was in office constituted or met the legal definition of genocide. And notably, this is something that the Biden administration has upheld. The State Department yesterday or the day before put out its most recent World Report on Human Rights, and it actually characterizes what's happening in Xinjiang as an ongoing process and also as a genocide. So this is a big deal, and it's increasingly a big deal. But what you don't have in terms of international opinion is you don't have any voices really out of the Muslim world at all. There are sort of the most telling vignette is that the Turkish president, Erdogan, was one of the very few Muslim leaders that was critical of what China is doing in Xinjiang. He was critical for a couple of years until in the summer of 2019, the Chinese central bank floated $1 billion loan to prop up the Turkish economy. And the Turkish political system has fallen silent regarding the Uyghurs since. And more so, countries like Saudi Arabia and the United Arab Emirates have actually done the opposite. They've gone to bat for the Chinese with the United Nations. They've sort of co-authored letters saying what China is doing. It's all, nobody should be paying attention. It's all internal Chinese business. They support China's sovereignty and territorial integrity. And there's a lot to say here, but the bottom line is what you're seeing is what I find a very troubling trend of the Chinese learning that they can do whatever they want without international criticism because they're effectively buying off countries that otherwise should arguably have a vested interest in the health and the welfare of their co-religionists. So that's the first sort of strategic trend, and I think it's a very pernicious one. The second equally pernicious one is that you're seeing increasingly a migration of Chinese digital authoritarianism along the Belt and Road into regions like the Middle East. And I'm sure all of you who are watching, who are listening, have heard bits and pieces of this about how China is erecting what has become the world's most pervasive authoritarian, digitally driven authoritarian system of repression. And it's true, I'm not getting paid for this, but my plug for this is if you want to read about what China's doing in this domain, there's a book called We Have Been Harmonized, which came out late last year, which really is a masterful, but it's also a terrifying look at how China has erected a social credit system, how China's working on things that they euphemistically call preventative policing, which is essentially using digital algorithms to apprehend people before they can do something that the party doesn't like. Everything from, you know, curating social media to promoting propaganda and everything in between. It's a system that's been remarkably successful in imposing conformity, imposing docility on the Chinese population itself. But increasingly, you're beginning to see that those technologies, the same technologies that the Chinese government has used to great effect against its own population, are beginning to migrate along the Belt and Road and to touch down in places like Iran, for example, where a Chinese company called ZTE has been one of the architects of the Iranian regime's campaign of digital repression, its own campaign of digital repression against the population after the, and this has sort of been going on for a decade, but it's intensifying, and you're increasingly seeing things like China begin to delve very deeply into the telecom sector in places like Lebanon or in Egypt. And to me, that's a very worrisome trend, because as someone who's spent quite a bit of time looking at what China's managed to do domestically, the repressive potential of these technologies that China is now offering for export as part of its partnership with countries in the Middle East, I think should raise a lot of alarms. It should raise a lot of alarms among Western policymakers. And so that's the second sort of pernicious effect. The third is that this is something that is beginning, and I would say this sort of in all fairness, the situation today is better than it was a couple of years ago, but for a while there, it was a trend that was very deeply affecting and had the potential to affect the health of the U.S.-Israeli strategic partnership, because the U.S. is sort of commonly understood to be the single largest nation state investor in Israel. But the expanding nature of Chinese investments in the Israeli high-tech sector specifically have put China on track to become the single largest nation-state investor in Israel in the span of a few years. And this was actually something that the Trump administration was very concerned about. And the Trump administration was, as all of you know, sort of very pro Israel and sort of very aware and sort of responsive to Israeli national security concerns. But the one issue that where there was a tremendous amount of friction and it resolved, thankfully, sort of fairly constructively, but there's a tremendous amount of friction on from the U.S. side was a growing worry that they communicated to their Israeli interlocutors that the level of Chinese investment in everything from dual use technology to innovative software and artificial intelligence to, for example, Chinese administration of the port in Haifa, had the potential, if it wasn't properly curated, to adversely affect the health of the U.S.-Israeli strategic partnership. It was something that the Israelis were responsive to, and the situation is now better. The Israelis did things like set up a working group similar to our CFIUS, the Committee on Foreign Investment in the United States, at the national security level in Israel. National Security Council level in Israel, specifically to counter and to sort of to address those concerns. But China is very interested in Israel, I think very understandably, because Israel is the region's leading knowledge economy, and China sort of wants to innovate, and China wants to optimize what it's doing itself inside the PRC. And so that's a trend that I think is worth watching. It's not uniformly negative as the other ones are, but it's worth watching. The last point I'll make, and then I'll stop, is that I think we're beginning to see a shift in the way China thinks about the Middle East. And the reason I say this is because historically, in recent years, Chinese Middle East policy has been very balanced. China engages with Iran, China engages with Syria, for example. But that level of outreach is counteracted, at least the Chinese think so, by these deep investments in countries like Saudi Arabia or Qatar or Kuwait or the United Arab Emirates. And so, you know, they've tried, I think, very successfully so far to straddle the Sunni Shiite divide in the region. But now it looks like the Chinese are beginning to choose sides. And the reason I say this is because over the weekend, Chinese Foreign Minister Wang Yi carried out a state visit to Tehran, and he concluded or he officially signed a landmark strategic accord with his Iranian counterpart, Javad Zarif. So the new Sino-Iranian deal, which all of you, I'm sure, have read a little bit about, it's not a new phenomenon. In fact, there's been sort of news about this and literature about this ever since this past summer, when Zarif announced publicly that the Iranian parliament, the Majlis, was actually sort of considering the terms and was looking at the dimensions, but there wasn't a lot of detail divulged. And there aren't a lot of details divulged now, but it looks more or less like what Wang and Zarif signed over the weekend is pretty much what was being considered by the Iranian parliament 7-8 months ago. And that involves everything from a preferential stance for China in the Iranian telecom sector to expanded port access for Chinese merchant vessels and also the Chinese People's Liberation Army Navy at southern Iranian ports, and sort of everything in between. The price tag that's been attached to this is something on the order of $400 billion. Which is a massive, massive deal if it actually materializes. It's not clear that all of the prongs will actually become viable levels of cooperation. But if it does, this is, I think, one to watch. The impetus for China, I think, is very clear. The Chinese are increasingly adversarial. They're increasingly ambitious globally, but they're increasingly adversarial with the United States. And the Chinese see an opportunity to sort of to counteract and to act as a spoiler for U.S. policy in the Middle East by engaging with Iran, because it makes Iran stronger, and also because it essentially does an end run around the Biden administration's efforts to engage with the Islamic Republic and to bring them back to the negotiating table. The impetus for Iran, I think, is very clear. Also, the Iranians, after 2 years, roughly 2 years of maximum pressure, under the Trump administration, the Iranian economy is in big trouble. And I know it's not sort of politic to say so, but objectively, intellectual honesty demands that you take a look at the health of the Iranian economy, what's happening inside the country, the level of Iranian oil exports, and how it's dropped precipitously. And you come away with this understanding that maximum pressure may not have caused the regime to crumble or caused the regime to buckle, but it had a very serious material effect on Iran's economic health. And it increasingly made them desperate for international partners. And that's why you see a lot of coverage of this new Sino-Iranian deal as being a diminution of Iranian sovereignty, essentially how Iran's Ayatollahs are selling off parts of the Islamic Republic because they want to stay in business. I think that commentary is simplistic, but it's not very far from the mark. I think that's what's driving a lot of Iranian receptiveness to Chinese overtures. And so here, I think there's a really interesting pivot point, and we're going to need to watch for the next couple of months, because historically, as I said, the Chinese have taken pains to balance engagement with the Sunnis and engagement with the Shiites. This new deal threatens to upend that equation. And of course, the Chinese government's going to go to Riyadh and go to Abu Dhabi and go to Kuwait City and say, really, nothing's changed. You don't need to worry about this at all. But for these Arab countries, for these Sunni Arab countries, they need to take a look at what China has actually concretely signed with Iran and try to figure out whether partnership with China is still a smart bet over the long run. Increasingly, I think the sort of the silver lining in all of this, if there is one, is that even though China is making big moves in the Middle East, some of those moves may create strategic opportunities that the United States and its allies can exploit if we're deft about it. So I'll stop there.
Great. Thank you for that fascinating talk, Elon. And there's obviously a lot to unpack, and you know, and giving us a lot to think about. So the floor is obviously now open, and we will take as many questions as we can. Again, you can type in your questions via the chat or raise your virtual hand. Alex, why don't you start us off with the conversation, if that's okay?
Sure. Thanks very much for the presentation, which covered a tremendous amount of ground. My question was going to be about Gulf perceptions of Iranian-Chinese relations, which you touched on in your few minutes of your comments. But let me broaden this a little bit, or triangulate a little bit, and ask the same question, but how it fits in with the Biden administration's new or changed policy towards towards Saudi Arabia, creating daylight, maybe, certainly with respect to human rights, and not at the level of arguing for regime change, but certainly having a new and more critical tone, and obviously its continued outreach towards Iran and the effort to recreate some version of the JCPOA nuclear agreement, and how does China fit into this equation?
Right. Well, so I think there's a lot to be said here, but 2 points that I think are germane. First of all, I think as a sort of best practices thing, it's really useful for American policymakers to understand what China is doing, sort of the scope of what China is doing in the Middle East. If nothing else, because the Chinese very clearly are outflanking the United States in the region. And this is directly, I think, important to the Biden administration, because it's sunk so much political capital already into the idea of re-engagement with Iran, of bringing Iran back into the folds of the JCPOA, and ideally, optimally creating a follow-on agreement. But if the Biden administration, if the new White House ever gets to that point where the Iranians are willing to talk, they're going to find a really interesting situation where the Iranians are not coming as supplicants. The Iranians are actually stronger than they thought they would be, because they're increasingly relying on the Chinese to prop them up. And as we've seen sort of from the contours of the details of the deal that is emerging, the Iranians are not beyond selling off parts of the country and sort of ceding some of their sovereignty in order to get a strengthened regional hand. So that's one thing. The other thing is that I think the Sino-Iranian deal can be useful for American policymakers. And I sort of mentioned this briefly in my remarks, but before sort of the webinar started, Alex, you and I were talking about how I was in Saudi Arabia early last year before we all got locked down. One of the really interesting takeaways from, you know, the series, you know, I did a series of meetings during the week that I was in Riyadh, it was the discussion about China, where this was sort of, you know, during the Trump administration, when great power competition was very much locked in terms of how the Trump administration thought about China, the Saudis were not buying it. And I heard in multiple meetings, variants of the same phrase, which is, great power competition doesn't really involve us. We're tangential. We're on the side of great power competition, which I think is not a tenable stance. And it's not a tenable stance under the Biden administration either, because after early indications that they might try a softer approach, I think the Biden administration is now increasingly pivoting to embrace wholeheartedly great power competition. And you see this from the way the State Department has sort of strengthened its language in the aftermath of that fairly uncomfortable summit in Alaska that the Secretary of State had with Foreign Minister Wang, and also in the way the State Department is now talking about genocide, how President Biden has talked about the need for long-term competition. All of this suggests to me that there's going to be a lot of questions that are asked by the United States to our regional partners and allies about where they stand in all this, right? And this is germane for Saudi Arabia, certainly, but it's also germane for countries like Israel. Because a lot of these countries, and you know, Saudi Arabia and Israel are, I think, are good examples in this regard, is they've tried to hermetically seal off their relationship, their bilateral relationships with Washington on the one hand, and their bilateral relationships with Beijing on the other. And I'm not sure that that's a tenable proposition moving forward.
Great. Alex, no follow-up, or if we move on to other questions?
No, let's move on. Thanks very much.
Great. All right. So, Ilan, we have a variety of questions, you know, going on, and we'll try to combine some of them. You know, many of our members obviously are in the academy, so there's a lot of questions about also institutional and university and scientific collaboration. So let me try to combine some of these. So Jeffrey Sheff is asking, are there Chinese students attending Israeli scientific institutes? And in the same vein, my friend and colleague Shlomo Dubnov, you know, is asking, you know, about the academic collaboration. There's obviously a great deal of joint universities like NYU Shanghai and Duke Kushan, you know, who are, you know, that he works with both. Is there any parallel with Israeli universities? And is there a way to leverage U.S.-China academic ties, you know, with these universities? And obviously, you know, in the same, you know, obviously, is there a threat or a downside to these collaborations, given what you're describing as far as, you know, China's ties with Iran now, and obviously the growth, you know, on the other side, we've known about the growth of Muslim studies in Chinese universities. So maybe you want to kind of tackle some of these issues in your response.
Sure. So let me start by saying that I don't know with regard to the degree to which Israeli universities are open to Chinese foreign exchange students, the sort of level of Chinese attendance at Israeli universities. I don't know. I would imagine. I'm not strictly speaking part of the part of academia, so I peg my ignorance on that. But I would imagine that if it's any sort of analog, you know, at least in some way to what's happening in the United States, that there is a fair amount. And then the sort of the interesting question becomes how Israel is addressing this problem. And I say the word problem advisedly, because if the U.S. experiences any indication, what we've seen over the last several years has been an increasingly aggressive attempt by the Chinese government to provide seed money for China studies programs to set up what they call Confucius Institutes to promote China's image abroad. They're increasingly migrating into academia. A great example of this is the kerfuffle that happened last year over at the University of Texas in Austin, where there was a China studies program that was being considered, but the seed money was linked back to the Communist Party of China. It's something, by the way, for those of you that are interested in the incident, it's actually captured in pretty accurate detail in Josh Rogan's new book on China. This is, I think, something that is of growing concern, and certainly of growing concern to U.S. lawmakers about the level of Chinese penetration of U.S. academia and the freedom, sort of, you know, the distorting effect that has on academic freedom, and the distorting effect that has on China studies and an accurate representation of both the good and the bad that China presents. So I would say this is sort of a teachable moment. I think if politics are any judge, Israel tends to be, you know, a couple of strides behind us in terms of the problems that it tackles. And this may be something that's coming down the pike in Israeli academia that we really haven't seen surface quite as much there as it has here already.
Great, thank you. So a segue to that question, you know, asking by our friend Elliot Miller. So how does the Sino-Iranian deal impact the dynamics between China and Israel? I mean, you know, kind of, you know, on the national security level, given, you know, what the Israelis have been dealing with, and obviously, you know, you have this academia track that's going on as far as collaboration. And we do know, and you know, we've observed over the past few years, the amount of Chinese students coming and going to the Technion, which seems to be a huge flow, you know, as far as the Israeli State Department versus the national security apparatus in that regard, vis-a-vis the threats in the region.
Right. Well, no, and by the way, to point out, that makes total sense, right? The sort of the influx of technically minded Chinese students into Israel, where especially sort of innovative computing, innovative technological development is such a strong suit makes total sense, right? It's one of the reasons why the Chinese have sort of invested so deeply in the Jewish state to begin with. But I think that's an interesting question, because we have to, I think, wait and see what the regional reverberations of the Sino-Iranian deal are going to be, because this is a new thing, right? Up until the deal was, we knew sort of in the back of our minds that the deal was sort of in the works, but it wasn't a done deal yet until this weekend. And so it was possible to pursue the fiction that, you know, the Chinese wanted to be friends with everybody. The Chinese were essentially pursuing an equivocal, broad-based approach to the region. It wasn't preferring Sunnis over Shiites. It wasn't preferring Shiites over Jews in terms of engagement with Israel. But obviously, the fact that China has now inked such a mammoth deal, such a large strategic foothold for itself in the region, and with the ancillary effect of strengthening the Iranian regime, is going to have reverberations, not only for Israeli national security, although there is that, but also for the security of the Gulf Arab states as well. So my hope is that Israeli policymakers, who have tended to be somewhat cavalier about American concerns about the corrosive effect of Chinese penetration, right? Historically, there hasn't really been an Israeli, very receptive audience in Israel for that. My hope is that this this new accord really sort of opens their eyes and leads them to ask more of the correct questions.
Great. So, you know, this is a segue to that question. You know, Robert Brown is asking, as a result of, you know, what you're describing, and again, these China-Israeli relations, is there a way to leverage some of that when it comes to China and the United Nations, when it comes to Israel in those regards? I mean, is that something that, you know, is worth pursuing or looked at, you know, as a result of what the, you know, how those ties are playing out?
Listen, I think it's absolutely worth pursuing, and I would imagine that the Israeli government is pursuing that. But if they are, it hasn't really had that much of an effect, right? You're not seeing a discernible lessening in anti-Israel animus at the Security Council level or at the UN Human Rights Council level or what have you. I mean, if I was advising the Israeli government, my suggestion would be sort of precisely this, which is, you know, the Chinese should understand that they need to pay to play, and the coin that they can pay, and it's not just monetary, it's also in terms of political influence. At least up until now, the Israelis haven't been very successful in leveraging that economic track that they have with the Chinese into getting the Chinese to sort of to tamp down the anti-Israel initiatives that take place on the international scene. My sense is they've probably asked. I would imagine there's not that much appetite for it on the Chinese side, but it's certainly something worth exploring.
Great, thank you. Moving on to Sharon's question. So you mentioned in your conversation the repression of the Uyghurs, and so she's asking, are they trying to also do it outside of China as well? And is that you know, is that something that the Arab world is concerned about, as a result of, you know, impacting, you know, Muslim communities outside of the Arab, you know, as far as, you know, the Middle East at large?
So the answer is a little bit. You see a spillover effect. So if you sort of pull up a map, I don't have a map behind me, but if you pull up a map of China, what you'll see is that Xinjiang abuts something like 8 majority Muslim countries, right? Everything from Pakistan to Central Asian states to, you know, whatever it is. So there's a lot of the reason I bring this up is because I think it's necessary to understand what China is doing against the Uyghurs is sort of geopolitically driven. My colleague Michael Soblik, who's a real China expert, has done a lot of work on the Belt and Road specifically, and he has this handy dandy graphic which shows that fully half of the land routes of the quote unquote Belt and Road actually run through Xinjiang, right? So if you are sitting in Beijing and you're part of the Communist Party of China, and you think that, you know, sort of you want people to be subservient to the state, you see religion, whether it's Islam or Christianity or Judaism or whatever, as being an inherent threat because it suborns identity. And it creates an alternative identity for Chinese citizens so that they're less beholden potentially to the party. You combine that with the geopolitical imperatives of pacifying Xinjiang because you need it to further your premier foreign policy initiative. And you get a long way towards understanding why the Chinese are doing what they're doing. And you're seeing that spillover effect where the Chinese are sort of, you know, putting pressure on neighboring countries like Kazakhstan to sort of, you know, to repatriate Uyghurs, not to give them safe haven if they fled the province. And you're seeing on the international level, Chinese efforts to discredit the World Uyghur Congress, which is the sort of the global organization for the rights of Uyghurs that sort of acts actively internationally. But you're not seeing a Chinese campaign to hunt down Uyghur dissidents abroad. It hasn't gone that far. But what you're seeing is a clean and open playing field for the Chinese to do whatever they want inside the country, because they've managed to purchase, for lack of a better word, to purchase Muslim acquiescence, Muslim silence about it.
Great, thank you. So apropos, you know, my friend Judy Hirshon is asking a question related to what we spoke about a little bit before we started the conversation regarding the Khashoggi affair and, of course, you know, the human rights abuses. And so, you know, she's posing the question is, you know, the Biden administration, you know, is that a blunder as far as going after Saudi human rights, you know, abuses while ignoring Iran and China? You know, where does that leave, you know, the priorities as far as dealing, you know, obviously you mentioned before, you know, the centrality of the Khashoggi affair as it relates to, you know, U.S.-Saudi relations. What about you, you know, what about these issues as it relates to Chinese abuses? And maybe you want to talk about, obviously, the topic of the day, which, you know, related to COVID, you know, and how does all this play into all this as well, you know, as U.S.-Chinese relations?
Right. Well, so it's an interesting question. And I'll share, Asaf, what we talked about, you know, a couple minutes before the webinar started, because I had mentioned that Saudi Arabia was my last foreign trip before I got locked down, and that I was really struck by the level of, and mind you, this was over a year ago, but I was really struck by the level of Saudi complacency with regard to Khashoggi. There really wasn't an appreciation of how much the Khashoggi affair had influenced American perceptions of Saudi Arabia and how much appetite there was to exact some sort of punishment. And so there was a very cavalier attitude on the part of the Saudis with regard to this. They from their perspective, sitting in Riyadh, they thought that Yemen was a much bigger international issue. And I tried to explain to them that virtually no American who doesn't sort of focus on the Persian Gulf understands what's happening in Yemen, but everybody knows about the Khashoggi affair. And so I frankly wasn't surprised by the Biden administration's pivot. There had been rumblings for a long time that the incipient Biden administration was going to take a different tack than the Trump administration did towards Saudi Arabia. The Trump administration, because of the other considerations, because they were trying desperately to get the Saudis on board the unfolding Abraham Accords, there really wasn't a lot of significant wrist slapping done with regard to the Khashoggi affair. The Trump team simply thought that there were bigger fish to fry. So I wasn't surprised by the sort of the rebalancing. I tend to think that the Biden administration has the way it sort of recalibrated its approach to Saudi Arabia. We'll have to see what the long-term effects are, but I did appreciate the White House fell in line with the old axiom that you should never forbid what you can't prevent, because there were people here in town that were calling for personal sanctions on the Crown Prince, on Mohammed bin Salman, and sort of, you know, a U.S. threat to upend the relationship with the kingdom altogether. The Biden administration didn't go that far, among other things, because I think they understood that it would nuke the relationship altogether. But obviously, there's a very different approach to Saudi Arabia that's happening now. But I would actually argue that it's pretty consistent. If you think, and we have to wait and see whether the Biden administration takes a more forceful approach on human rights towards, you know, China, towards Russia, or whatever it is. But if it does, it would be intellectually consistent to talk about Saudi human rights abuses and talk about Chinese human rights abuses. So my sense is, I think that cake really isn't baked yet. While I don't approve of everything that the White House has done with regard to Saudi Arabia, my sense is that there's, the big target that we should be looking at is that the Vision 2030 has uncorked a whole bunch of very profound societal and economic changes. And we shouldn't do anything to derail that trajectory, because it's still sort of incipient and it can still be derailed, and Saudi Arabia can go back to the status quo ante pretty easily. I understand at least the intellectual underpinning of what the Biden administration is trying to do in terms of holding them to account. Whether that's a winning strategy is another matter entirely.
Great, thank you. So really tied into, another point that you mentioned before, Jack is asking, how does, the China's policy towards Iran, in that regard allowed them to, what he's defining as escape the U.S. sanctions, as far as biting sanctions and whatnot. And maybe if you've seen a little bit, how this is being circumvented politically and economically. And is there ways I'm adding here that we can obviously deal with that? The one other thing I wanted you to talk about in the question before, maybe also the impact of COVID as it relates to the pandemic, as far as, U.S.-China relations, maybe there's a way there as well to put, pressures and more biting sanctions regarding the Iranians and the Chinese at the same time.
Right. Well, you sort of, I'm happy to talk about it. It sort of shunts the conversation a little bit into Biden-Iran strategy, which is unfortunately sort of a stalking horse of mine as well. So I'm happy to sort of expound on it. It looks to me like what the Biden administration is trying to do I'm a firm believer in the fact that personnel is policy, and the personalities that now populate the Biden administration are, as I'm sure all of you have noted, the very same personalities that were instrumental to inking the 2015 JCPOA in the first place. So the idea that the Biden administration would be driving very quickly towards a re-entry in the deal as sort of maybe as a standalone, maybe as a sort of a precursor to doing something else, frankly, is not surprising, right? Tony Blinken and Jake Sullivan and Wendy Sherman, especially Rob Malley, these are all names that were sort of circulated very heavily with regard to the 2015 deal. I'm not sure that their opinion of the prudence of that deal has changed very much. So this shouldn't be a surprise. What you have, though, is a question of sequencing and a question of leverage. So the Trump administration succeeded in imparting a lot of leverage as a result of maximum pressure, imparting it to the Biden administration. The question is, are we going to use that leverage? Are we going to use Iran's need for more stable markets for its oil exports? Are we going to help, are we going to allow countries to liberate frozen assets that were frozen as a result of maximum pressure? And then the question is sequencing. Even if we're considering doing that, are we going to do it first? Do they have to come to the table first? All the indicators on both of those things, I think, are unfortunately negative. The Biden administration has not yet given massive sanctions relief to Iran, but my sense is that that's coming down the pike, and it's coming down the pike because in recent days you've heard sort of rumblings about the fact that the administration is very concerned that the Iranians haven't sort of bitten on the notion of new negotiations yet, and they're willing to now consider preemptive sanctions relief as a way of getting the Iranians back to the table. So that answers both questions, right? We cede leverage and we go first. And this is where I think COVID comes in, because COVID provides another excuse for the Biden administration to do what they want to do anyway. Because even before he became president, Joe Biden was talking about how Iran needs sanctions relief for humanitarian purposes, because Iran's been the Middle Eastern country hardest hit by the pandemic and what have you. Now that he is in the saddle and his administration is driving towards re-engagement with Iran, I think you're already beginning to see signs that they're seriously considering expanding the humanitarian exception, for lack of a better term, and using humanitarian needs relating to the pandemic as a way of shoehorning in preemptive sanctions, really. So my sense is, unfortunately, that's where we're heading.
Great. Thank you for that. So my friend Ken Moskowitz is asking about the strategic opportunity, you know, given that some states in the Belt and Road appear to be rebelling from the Chinese heavy hand. Is that happening in the Middle East as well? And he's also asking, are there objections, you know, to that, you know, from Iran selling its sovereignty? So can we, you know, maybe you want to tackle some of that as well?
Right. Well, let me do that last one first and then sort of back into it.
Sure.
There's a really fascinating thing and profound thing that's happening within Iran now. I say this advisedly because I'm somebody who's spent a lot of time researching and talking to the various strains of the Iranian opposition. And, you know, my glass half empty conclusion for a long time has been that the whole is less than the sum of its parts, that there's lots of different opposition movements, but they're all fighting with one another. There's not a coherent strategy or platform that they can coalesce around. And that's why it's been so easy for the regime to pick them off. And that's why what's happening in Iran over the last 3 weeks or so is really so profound, because you're seeing this new campaign called, the slogan is No to the Islamic Republic, but it's beginning to draw support from all these different opposition groups, as well as from, Iranian dissidents, Iranian media personalities, cultural personalities, in a way that really you haven't seen before. And my sense is that's part of this understanding by the Iranian opposition that there's promise and peril on the part of sort of this current moment in time. Because on the one hand, there's Iranian elections coming up later this year. There's already signs that Iranian clerical institutions prefer a hardliner in the vein of Mahmoud Ahmadinejad to revitalize resistance to the West and opposition to the West. Because technocracy under Hassan Rouhani has clearly failed. On the other hand, you have a United States that is increasingly interested, not in talking to them, but in talking to the Iranian regime. So they feel like now is the moment to make their voice heard. And these same people are the ones that are speaking the most vocally about how how the Ayatollahs have essentially sold off Iranian sovereignty as a result of this new deal with China. I tend to think they're right. The proof is in the pudding, though, because increasingly there are calls for Iran or China or both to disclose what's actually in the deal. The Chinese, I think, very understandably, have remained mum. The Iranian regime will or not is a different story. But I think, you know, the more details about the deal come out, the more we're going to have an accurate understanding of exactly what's transpired. It's pretty early days yet. And remind me again what the first question was. I'm sorry.
Where was? Let's go back to. Again, he was. Ken was mentioning whether or not the question regarding the rebelling against the Iranian sovereignty as a result of that as well. I mean, so is that.
Right. So I think I tried to cover that a little bit. I mean, my sense is that there is a pretty fertile field of Iranian opposition in Iran itself. And it's increasingly these are people who are feeling like, you know, now is their moment to maybe come together if they can, but certainly to have their voices heard on the international scene.
Great. Thank you for that. So I think you answered this question as well already, in your last comment. Alex, with the time that we have left, how about we go back to you for another question?
Sure. I think in listening to all this, I'm curious about how you would predict the scene generally a year from now and then maybe 5 years from now. So we have a situation where certainly in the American foreign policy establishment there's a considerable resistance to characterizing the situation as an American-Chinese Cold War, but the signs are there. And one of the functions of the last Cold War was the necessity to create new security architectures and for countries to be convinced that it was in their interest to join at least the American side, the Western side. And where do you think this is going a year from now and let's say 5 years from now?
No, so I think that's a great question because it really sort of distills down everything we've been talking about. So I would answer it this way. I think there is a understanding now, a bipartisan understanding now in Washington about the need for great power competition with China, right? The old idea of China as a responsible stakeholder, right? This was sort of very in vogue for a quarter of a century, the idea that through greater economic opportunities, political engagement, you could make China a responsible stakeholder on the world stage. That's really sort of fallen away. And I would argue that in geopolitical terms, that's one of the most important contributions of the Trump administration, this sort of popularizing the understanding that that great power competition is here to stay, that this is sort of, we're now seeing the true nature of China. But what I don't think we have yet is a true understanding of all the different permutations of great power competition. The Chinese are remarkable in the fact that they have national plans for everything. They have national plans for international expansion. They have national plans for artificial intelligence. They have national plans for space exploitation. And that, I think, is hugely significant because we don't have anything resembling a sort of holistic understanding of what great power competition will entail. And that's going to rebound inevitably. It's going to rebound to how China interacts with countries that we may be partners with or we may be allies with, and how we interact with them. So a great example would be the sort of the scramble that's taking place for Africa now between the United States and China. And by the way, not the only two players, right? Russia's involved, Iran to a much lesser degree is involved as well. But you're seeing these sort of very interesting vignettes about how, you know, authoritarian regimes in Africa are, after years of partnership with China, beginning to sort of to reconsider and maybe think that you know, throwing all their eggs in the Chinese basket is maybe not such a good idea. But they have to have workable alternatives. If you're a African leader, and you decide that, you know, for the stability of your regime, you may not want Chinese 5G technology in your telecom sector. You better be sure that you can find an alternative to 5G telecom. And right now, none of that really exists, right? The United States talks a lot about great power competition, but you're seeing very little by way of national strategies for advancing this competition from peeling off countries that China has hoarded onto itself and peeling them off and making them free agents, giving them the choice of choosing between apples and apples in terms of which side that they choose.
Great, thank you for that. Let me ask one more question with the time that we have, and I'm being cognizant of everybody's time. But David's last question here is, and you started to mention it in your last, you know, response here now. So really, how does Russia fit into all of this? Is their influence shrinking with all this result of the Chinese, Russia, Iran, you know, kind of triangle and all of this? And where do they play? You know, what's their, you know, maybe talk about a little bit, you know, what their end game is.
Well, it's interesting because when we talk about great power competition these days, we almost exclusively talk about China. But great power competition theoretically is supposed to encompass both. But Russia is a very different animal. Russia is a declining power. Right? It may not seem that way on the world stage because Russia, especially in the Middle East, has really advanced and deepened its footprint in the Middle East over the last half decade. Right, it's sort of used its military presence in Syria as this springboard to do a lot of things in the region, both in terms of arms sales and in terms of military engagement in throughout the African continent. But if you look internally at Russia itself, and it's something that I've studied for a long time, Russia is not a healthy place. It's not a healthy place, not only ideologically, although there's a lot that can be said about that. It's not a healthy place because Russia is declining demographically. Its economic situation is very bad. Vladimir Putin, his centrally organized ultra-nationalist regime is very focused on remaining in power, not in investing in national institutions and things like that. All of that cumulatively doesn't mean that Russia is not a threat globally or to the United States, but it does mean that Russia is a very different kind of threat than is China. China is rising. China is expanding geopolitically. Russia is internally declining. And a lot of what it's doing is the sort of the projection of a country that has great power ambitions, but feet of clay. And so, and this is, I think, important. And it's important because it means that the way we compete with Russia is going to be very different than the way we compete with China. As of right now, the Biden administration has given no sign that it has given any sort of substantial strategic thought to figuring out what to do with Russia, what the proper approach is. There's many things that can be done. A great place to start would be, sort of amplifying the plight of opposition activists like Alexei Navalny, who has just returned to Russia and been imprisoned by the Russian government. There's lots of stuff that can be done, but the prerequisite is sort of seeing Russia straight and sort of understanding that Russia is qualitatively a very different strategic challenge than China is.
Great, thank you. Ilan, really, I want to thank you for everything and really the fascinating conversation. Unfortunately, our time is short, and I do hope that you'll be able to come back at some other later date and talk to us again. So I really want to thank you again for taking the time. I want to thank everybody this afternoon for joining us. As always, I know we did not get to all the questions, and I apologize for that in advance. And now again, but you could always email us at bdsmonitor@spme.org, and we will do our best to follow up on those conversations. We will continue these webinar series as always, and so be on the lookout for more notices coming out. I want to thank Ilan again, and of course, Alex Jaffe, as always, for joining me. I hope everybody's staying safe and healthy, and I wish everybody a good morning or a good afternoon, depending on where you are located physically. And we will talk soon. So thank you and have a good day.
Thank you.